already in the title.
And the answer is really, listen, the round I can give is that there is no information loss simply because quantum space-time is sufficiently larger than the classical space-time. And we saw a little bit of this yesterday, how the resolution of singularities leads to larger space-times. Today we're going to look at black holes and see how it affects the issue of information loss.
So the organization of this talk is that first there's a short introduction and conceptual setting for the issue of information loss. Then the main and long part, the second part, these are Callan, Giddings, Harvey, and Strominger black holes. These are black holes in two space-time dimensions, and I will explain what they are. I realize that not everybody knows about them. And then we'll see what happens in these black holes, how information is actually recovered, somebody in outlook. This is a joint work with student Victor Tavares and Madhavan Varadarajan, and there was a short account in PRL this year, and we're writing the detailed paper these days. And some of the motivation came from some earlier work that I've done with Martin Boyle. So let us just start with the beginning. Let's look at the issue of information loss. So here is a Penrose diagram of Minkowski space-time. This is chi minus, this is chi plus, this is I zero, and this is R equal to zero. And we can, for zero response fields, we can give initial data of chi minus, and then we can evolve it. And basically, it sort of goes out here, and in the real world, it just goes through straight. In this diagram, it is reflected at R equal to zero in terms of chi plus. And you have a nice S matrix. Whatever in the initial state you give, if it's a pure state, you get a pure state out here. However, if for some reason I want you to do something slightly different, and I want you to say that in fact there is no chi minus, chi plus, but as a final surface, let me look at not a t equal to zero surface or chi plus, but just a hyperboloid in Minkowski space, a mass shell in Minkowski space, which goes out and it's asymptotically null, and therefore it hits chi plus up here. So I give myself a pure state here, it evolves, and of course it's a pure state of t equal to zero. But if I evolve further, part of the information is registered on this hyperboloid, but part of it goes out to infinity. And therefore, if I was interested just in the hyperboloid, for example, then I would find that all the information is not recovered. Or alternatively, if I was interested just in this part of scry, then I would find some of the information is not recovered because part of the information goes to the hyperboloid. The complete information is still there between the hyperboloid and scry. So if I had this as my total surface, future surface, then a pure state would go to a pure state here. But if I just choose to look at scry, then it would look like mixed state. And similarly, if I chose to look just at the hyperboloid and ignore what traced over the modes which went to scry, then it would look like mixed state. Now, if we had a gravitational collapse, then the situation is as follows. I can give myself a zero response field, like a zero response scalar field, for example. And I can actually give the data, which is falling in here. That makes a black hole. And I got a singularity at R equal to zero. And now, in this space-time, I ask if, in fact, all the information which I got at chi minus comes out at chi plus. But the answer is clearly no, because the future boundary of space-time is not just chi plus, but it's chi plus and a singularity, or chi plus and the horizon, if you like. And therefore, if I just look at chi plus, I'm losing the modes which traverse this way, so I'm going to trace over these modes, and therefore I would get an S matrix. I would get a density matrix. So information would be lost. Finally, this is the picture that Hawking first drew in his already in the paper in 74 and 75. About what would happen if the black hole actually evaporated. Now this picture does not have, I want to emphasize, any derivation behind it. It was just suggested by a plausibility argument. Namely, if you actually have a gravitational collapse and the black hole evaporates, the idea was that you have got here a strength of the gravitational singularity. Over here, the strength is very weak, as more and more matter falls in, the strength increases, and over here, it is kind of the psi 2, if you like, is as large as it is. It's, it goes like m upon r cube, and then if you have got here, m upon r cube up here. So over here, the idea is that I got a black hole. Again, here, normally the singularity will be m upon r cube, except that there's also Hawking evaporation, which goes out to infinity. And therefore, as time passes, the strength of the singularity weakens, this m decreases, and at some stage, m would just go to zero, and then the singularity would be zero upon r cube, so there is no singularity. And therefore, this is the end point of the evaporation process, and the idea was, then what happens next then? What happens in the future? And Hawking's idea was that, well, since the black hole has all completely evaporated away, in this future triangle, we should really think of space-time as being flat, and he just added on this flat piece of space-time. And then it was argued that in this picture, information is still lost. And that's absolutely right, because in this picture again, we see that scry minus is a good initial value surface, but scry plus is not a good initial value surface. Part of the information, part of the state, falls into the black hole, and therefore, if I were to look at as my final surface, the event horizon and scry plus, then the state is pure. But if I'm just interested in scry plus, then I'm tracing all these event horizon bits up here, and therefore the state is actually mixed. So the information loss occurs if scry plus is not the entire future boundary, if there is actually some singularity which can soak up this information. Now the question is then, what is going to happen in full quantum gravity? And in full quantum gravity, the picture that people are usually drawing, just looking at the Hawking picture, and one says that, well, we can trust this in a classical picture very well until the very end of the resolution of the singularity. And by then, whatever is happening here, almost all the masses evaporated away. And therefore, there's very little mass. And this, even if there is a remnant, this remnant is not large enough to account for the information that has been lost in the Hawking evaporation process, where you are getting a thermal state over here. And therefore, the information is really lost. But my viewpoint, coming from loop quantum gravity, but really this general viewpoint, is that this picture is wrong, not just here, but in fact is wrong all across the singularity. In the real world, there should be no singularity. So anytime the curvature is about Planck scale, some little region up here, this picture is completely wrong. And therefore, in fact, we have to sort of see what replaces this picture and what happens to the future of this picture. Now, I think Irani asked this question yesterday about black holes. I would say that, in fact, in general, the issue of what, so we cannot trust a semi-classical diagram near the entire singularity. And secondly, what happens to the event horizons? And I explained yesterday that event horizons are too global a concept, and Peter Hajek has given an argument that if I change the metric in the neighborhood of the singularity, the event horizons can completely disappear. Then the question is, what do we mean by a black hole? What evaporates? And as I explained yesterday, there are still trapping surfaces, there are still trapped surfaces, and so-called dynamical horizons. These are formed in completely tame regions in space-time, and that is what evaporates. And so we're led to a following picture. Namely, we've got this. This is again a classical picture. We've got here the matter falling in. And what happens is that the marginally trapped surface start developing here. And they grow. And then matter is stopped falling in. And then this area just remains constant. So here it is space-like, and here it becomes null. So what I would like to say is that we should really look at these dynamical horizons as a telltale signature of trapping or of some characteristics of black holes, and not worry about the event horizon at all. Because in full quantum gravity, there probably will be no event horizons. So the heuristic picture, there's no justification, just to get your intuition going, is that if you have full pure quantum gravity, then again, I get some state falling in up here, that might actually form a trapping surface up here. So this picture looks exactly like in a classical picture, but the classical relativity, there is nothing falling into the black hole or coming out of the black hole, and then the dynamical horizon becomes null. Here, something is coming out of black hole, namely Hawking particles, and as they are coming out, they're draining energy from the black hole, and you can show mathematically that then the dynamical horizon, which was fixed like here, becomes time-like. Like, that is why things can escape from here. It becomes time-like. It's no longer tracking in some ways. And things can escape out to infinity. So this is what is happening to the evolution of the dynamical horizon. It grows classically, and it shrinks quantum mechanically. Over here, we had the singularity. Now it is going to be replaced by some quantum region. And this quantum region, classical metric may not be well defined. There may be huge fluctuations of the quantum metric. But the picture is that these fluctuations will be restricted to some region up here. And if I move even further, then in fact I might again have a classical space-time, at least near sky plus, then a good classical space-time. And now I can have a picture like this, where, if you like, sky plus in this picture is bigger than sky plus in this picture. Basically, I've extended this space-time like that. And then the idea is that this sky plus may be large enough so that this is the entire future boundary now. And therefore, quantum mechanically, whatever state I add here could evolve and come back and give me a pure state here. Now, I want to emphasize, this is just a heuristic picture, but this is what is driving kind of the intuition coming from loop quantum gravity. And now what we want to do is to see if, in fact, this is something that does happen in the concrete models. And the model that we want to consider is really the CGHS model. And I'd like to show that in certain approximations, this scenario is actually realized.
Maybe I'm anticipating what you're going to say later, but if I look at the radiation that comes out from the underside of the quantum region, well, that's Hawking radiation. We know a lot about this, and we know it's low energy radiation. Whereas, you know, I sort of have a feeling that what comes off the top would be Planck scale particles that would, you know, maybe violate what is observed in the universe.
So, to the zeroth order, what is happening is that there is this quantum mechanical region, but because in the heuristic picture, these Hawking particles are going away, so there is that flux of negative energy that's coming in here. And therefore, the statement is that really out here, there's very little energy. And in fact, what we're going to see is that almost nothing comes, I mean, all the mass of the black hole really just comes out of the Hawking radiation. There is very little that comes out in the future region. But this is not something that we know in this picture, but this is what you'll see in this CGHS gap.
So, can I ask you something else? In the, are you saying that not all the surfaces inside the horizon are trapped? In the top picture, let's say. Yeah.
No. So this is a good question. Okay. So I'm saying that very good question. So this is in this classical space time, the state. I'm saying that in fact these surfaces up here, the expansion here is actually positive. So this surface is not trapped. And the reason why we don't normally see it, this is, you can just do it exactly using white dust space times and calculate what happens. And it really is true that in this region, I'm just looking at spherical, I should emphasize, I'm just looking at spherical round spheres. But if I just look at round spheres, the round spheres are not trapped here. That's a very good point, even though they are inside the event horizon. But they are trapped here. And the expansion is, this is marginally tracking. Every point there is a round sphere, and that is marginally tracking. And that is what happens in, for example, in the actual collapse of white dwarf space time. Or that is what happens if you look at the numerical evolution of a scale here. Okay. So what is the CGHS black hole? So let me start with the four-dimensional black holes. Okay. Spherically symmetric. Formed by some scalar field collapse, okay, just like the ones that we were considering a minute ago. Then, because it's spherically symmetric, it is convenient to factor out by the orbits of the Killing vector. And so what we're going to do is to write a 4 metric as being the RT metric. This is the minus plus signature metric. And the 2-sphere metric, so it's sphere, so there's a 2-dimensional metric up here. And this is, of course, a multiple of R squared. But it turns out to be convenient to just, instead of writing R squared, to write as e to the minus 2 phi. But then, of course, phi has no dimensions because I'm exponentiating them. And so I have to introduce in the theory, some quantity of dimension of inverse length. So I'm just calling this combination to be R squared to get the dimensions right here. And then I can take this 4 metric and write the action, the standard Einstein Hilbert action, in terms of the 2 metric. And so that is coming up here, the 2 metric. And the indices are raised and lowered with this 2 metric. The scalar field up here, so-called dilaton,
And of course, there is a constant that I introduce that will appear everywhere. And then the axon looks like that. It looks like in two dimensions, like the action in the direct of gravity. So I got a scalar curvature of this metric. I got even through phi. This is the standard term that you would expect for a sparsely scalar field. But then there are additional terms as well. And furthermore, now, so this dilaton is a part of the gravitational field. Dilaton is part of geometry. And then I also have a scalar field F here, which is actually causing the gravitational collapse. So I got in the system, what we had is a metric and a scalar field. And I've written down the metric in terms of a two-dimensional metric, a dilaton, and I still have a scalar field, and the action looks like that. If the CGHS model is inspired by some considerations that come from string theory, and in this case, the action one uses, again, the basic fields are a metric of signature minus plus, the line here, a scalar field, so scalar field F, and a dilaton, phi. And the action looks like this. You can see that there are these three terms, so I've got three terms up here, and this is the action for the scalar field, I got the action for the scalar field. The difference is just that here I got four, here it is two, that's not too important. However, the important thing is that over here, I got a factor of e to the 2 phi, and here I got a factor of e to the minus 2 phi, whereas here I just got a constant, and I got this e to the minus 2 phi here also, and here I do not have that factor. And finally, more importantly, this factor up here is missing. But still, I mean, structurally, the two models are rather similar. But it turns out that basically, just because these factors are missing, this model is exactly soluble. I don't have to worry about computer simulations or do anything. And this I found, by the way, as a pedagogical tool when I teach black holes, is very useful to students because you can actually make a black hole in a room. You know, actually write down the equations and then, you know, take a scalar field, collapse it, the horizon develops, you do everything. And everything can be done in one lecture. So it gives a very good intuition to students about how the dynamical black holes are formed. Okay. Now, in both these cases, as you might be surprised, that the 2 degrees of freedom is just in the scalar field. Because from a four-dimensional perspective, spherical symmetry, there are no gravitational waves. So the metric is completely determined by the scalar field that I've given you here. So here, the metric and the dilaton are going to be completely determined by the scalar field. But as I said, to emphasize, the equations are simpler in the CGHS case. In particular, if I just look at the equation of motion of F, I'm just going to get the equation to be block of F equal to zero. Here is much more complicated. I'm going to get a coupling between F and phi. Here I don't have that. So, now this equation in two dimensions is conformally invariant. Therefore, I can just say that the metric, assuming the topology is R2 throughout, so I'm just assuming that the metric is equal to some conformal factor times the Minkowski metric, flat metric up here. And then if this equation, this satisfies the field equation, the wave operator, wave equation with respect to G, then it satisfies it with respect to also eta. These are equivalent to each other. So the idea is that we can just take Minkowski space, we can solve for a wave equation, and then the gravitational field or the geometry is all contained in the metric or the compound factor and in the dilaton. And so I got dilaton and the compound factor, and the nice thing is that these are determined in a closed form, as we will see in the next transparency, by F and eta. And therefore you know the geometry completely, you can analyze it in detail. So how does it look like? So the answer to this is very simple, and I want to sort of emphasize this even though it is trivial, just because of the parallel with what happens in quantum theory. Namely, we just start with the Minkowski metric up here, and let's suppose that Z plus and Z minus are the advanced and the retarded coordinates with respect to Minkowski metric. And I got here an equation, which is the wave equation, that just tells me that the scalar field has either the left moving mode or right moving mode. In this case, we are going to consider a collapse of the left moving mode. It's just like what happens in Hawking theory. So let's just say that there is no right moving mode. So I got a left moving mode up here. And then the S matrix is trivial, right? I mean, this is a two-dimensional gravity, a two-dimensional scalar field. It just says that if you give me the wave function here, I know what the wave function here is completely. S matrix is in fact identity. There's nothing. But it's very simple. And there is no information loss in classical or quantum computing. And from now on, you start talking about left FL of Z plus. It only depends on Z plus. I'm just going to call it F plus so that you don't have to remember which is left and right. F plus of Z plus is what I'm giving you. And then that is the solution to the wave equation. Now I told you that if you give me a solution to a wave equation in Minkowski space, then I'm going to make you a black hole. So how do you make a black hole? What I will do is to tell you how to, what the dilaton is and what the scale of what the conformal factor is. So I have to solve some equations. I have not written down the equations because I'm going to write them down in the next transparency for the gravitational case, for the quantum case. But there are some simple equations to solve, differential equations, and you can solve them explicitly. It just turns out to be convenient that instead of using the z plus minus, which are really the coordinates up here, the expression is shorter if I just introduce x plus minus, which are just exponentials of z plus minus. So this is just a small technicality. You can work with z plus minus, it's just that the transparency is pretty long.
Isn't it true? Do you have in two spatial dimensions, do you have dynamical modes? The gravitons don't propagate.
No, so in this case, the statement is that there are no, in this case, the complete degree of freedom is in the scalar field. There is no gravitational.
No gravitational dynamics.
There is no gravity. I mean, there's gravitational dynamics, but it's Coulombic. It's like dynamics. I mean, there's no gravitational modes. Metric is not static. There are no true degrees of freedom in the gravitational field. The metric is completely determined by what happens in the...
So what do you mean by a black hole in that case?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's what we're... I'm about to answer. So, exactly, this is the question. I mean, I just told you that I got a scalar field in the Minkowski space, how can there be a black hole, right? So I'm going to define for you the dilaton, and I'm solving the equations, actually, and the conformal factor. So, I just set theta as a field, which is to be equal to, it's basically replacing the conformal factor. The conformal factor is going to be equal to theta to the minus 1. This omega is going to be theta to the minus 1 times e to the minus 2 phi. That is to say the dilaton field. This is the dilaton. So I'm just replacing the conformal factor by a new quantity called theta. So just set theta equal to minus kappa squared x plus x minus. And then set phi, the dilaton term, to be equal to theta minus a double integral of the energy density in the scalar field that is falling in. So I'm just doing a double integral of energy up here. And I at the moment, don't ask, I don't expect you to understand why this is a solution. I'm just telling you. It's a small exercise, takes 20 minutes, 15 minutes to solve it. And if you do that, you're going to get this as a solution. So the statement is that we got a solution to... And then you just set g to be equal to omega phi, omega times theta, omega is just given by this.
Is it the most general solution?
Yeah, it's the most general solution. Satisfying the boundary conditions.
Which
I'll tell you in a second. Okay. Satisfying the boundary conditions you want to satisfy, namely that in the distant past, I'll tell you in the next transparency. Now the question is, why is there a black hole? Because you look at the solution, right? F is a completely regular field. I just give you incoming profile, some profile here, F. It's a completely seen 3D field with some complex support. This is a completely, phi is completely well defined everywhere here. Theta I have explicitly defined for you, kappa squared x plus x minus. It's completely well defined everywhere here. How can there be a black hole? Well, there's a black hole because the physical metric is not eta, but the physical metric is g. And that is given by theta to the minus 1 phi times omega. You say, okay, but omega is everywhere well defined, so why is there a problem? The problem is that there is a space-like line along which omega vanishes. When omega vanishes, this metric is not well defined. Covariant metric blows up. You can calculate the curvature of this metric, and you find that the curvature, scalar curvature, blows up along that space-like line. Again, it is a fact that it is always a space-like line, right? And show it again, just a few lines. That's why it's very good to teach students this thing. Yeah? Okay. So. And that's why I got here a space-like line along which omega is equal to zero. Therefore, although these fields, theta, phi, and f, are well-defined everywhere in this Minkowski diamond, the physical metric is well-defined only to the path of the space-like line. This is singularity. And then, there's a black hole because I just look at, this is a physical scrap, physical null infinity of GAB. You can check that this is complete. This cry is complete. The affine parameters of the duality after the time translation with respect to g runs from minus to plus infinity up here. But if I look at the past of this scribe plus, it's not entire space-time. There's a part of space-time which is missing, and this part of space-time is where there's a backup.
To the future of this this line where omega vanishes, and I don't know, does this have any significance?
Yeah, so no, it's difficult to interpret the solution. What happens is that the singularity appears to be naked, this is not infinity there, so I do not know how to interpret it. It's a solution, you know. So the singularity is space-like, then there are these analog track points, which are like the track surfaces, and their world line is exactly like the dynamical horizon. It grows and then becomes null here after all the matter has fallen in up here. And if in this model, in this space-time, I were to go do now the calculation of Hawking effect, then I find that in fact there is information loss. Why? The calculation is done as follows. The black hole is formed by F plus. Now I look at dynamics of F minus on this space-time. And this is exactly what happens in black hole, in the Hawking effect. The star collapses, that forms a black hole, and then we look at the dynamics of a scalar field, which is a distinct test scalar field. So here we can look at a test scalar field, which is F minus. You give yourself initial data on star minus up here. Again, we just saw here that the equation is just a wave equation. So if I give myself initial data up here, I can evolve it in Minkowski spacetime and get a good initial data or good field everywhere here. In fact, the S matrix is a trigger, so I'll get the entire field up here. So in Minkowski space-time, there's no information loss. But the physical space-time G, the interpretation, has all to be done with respect to G. And G does not have access to this part of scribe of Minkowski space-time. Scribe G is just this. Therefore, I have to trace all these modes. And secondly, as I go from here to here, there's a gravitational field which is non-trivial here. Here space-time is flat, here it is static, but there's a non-trivial dynamical field up here. Therefore, positive and negative frequency up here get mixed up with respect to positive and negative frequency up here. You do the detailed calculation, and you find that indeed, after tracing over, the vacuum state, I take the vacuum state and evolve it. This vacuum state is pure, stupid vacuum state of Minkowski space-time on this flat plus. There's nothing there. However, I am led to trace all these modes, and I am led to reinterpret the modes in terms of the time translation of G. And when I do that, I find that what I have is the density matrix, which is precisely thermal, and that is the Hawking radiation that we talk about. So it's a very beautiful example as a toy model for teaching in class, because you can do it all in a relatively short amount of time. Now we want to go to quantum theory, and this is the key point, so let's start here. So, one of the things that we saw, is that the physical space-time is only part of the Minkowskian fiducial space-time that I began. But which part am I going to get depends on the initial data. If I gave my initial data to n here, then this is what I get. If I were to tell you that the initial data is 0 here, and it ends, and just starts here, non-zero just here, then the space-time would be larger. The physical space-time would be part of some space like here. So what part of Minkowski space I get depends on the initial data. Therefore, if you want to look at the kinematical arena on which to pose your theory, either the phase space or the quantum quantization, then you are likely to consider that your kinematical arena is in fact all of Minkowski space. Only part of it might be realized in dynamical solutions, but your kinematical arena would be only part of Minkowski space. So I got here m naught and eta is just the kinematical arena. But dynamical fields are going to be 2 degrees of freedom, which is the scalar field F hat. And then geometry is all going to be contained in either the dilaton and the conformal factor, but for mathematical convenience reason, we take them to be dilaton and a field theta, such that omega is equal to phi times theta minus 1. And the answer, the picture that we're working with, this is what we mean by solution to the theory. Solution to the theory will consist of finding an operator value distribution phi hat and a positive operator theta, or operator field theta, satisfies some equations. Where do these equations come from? They come from quantization of the classical theory that you have. What are those equations? Well, these are the equations that we have. Mainly. First of all, this field is a trivial field. Yeah, I mean, just a zero response scalar field on the Minkowski space. So we solve it, we know everything about it. This is a very trivial field. And it is the field that I've written down up here. And then finally, what about fine theta? Well, we look at the classical equations, we look at canonical quantization, and we reconstruct the equations. It has to satisfy equation which looks like d plus d minus just referred to the plus g plus z minus coordinates on the Minkowski space. So d plus d minus of phi hat plus this constant k squared times theta hat is equal to something constructed out of certain stress energy components, I think, and then phi hat phi hat times d plus d minus of log of theta hat is equal to minus g times t plus minus of omega. So the question is, what is a mechanism? And this is a subtlety of quantum mechanics. The classical theory, I got this field F, and this field F is zero response, so the stress energy tensor has no trace. But in this two-dimensional model, there is a trace anomaly, and that trace anomaly is completely determined by the conformal factor that I got up here. So there's a formula for t plus minus in terms of omega hat. I could have written it down, just a long expression. But if you give me omega hat, then I know what this operator is. So these two equations are equations, they're hyperbolic. They're equations just involving theta hat and phi hat. This seems confusing, because well, what happened to scalar field? Scalar field seems to exist by itself. How is it coupled to this? After all, the curvature is caused by the scalar field in classical theory. The way it is coupled is we have boundary conditions. And the boundary conditions here are that on sky minus, where we have left sky minus and right sky minus, on all of sky minus, theta hat is supposed to be just equal to kappa squared times x plus x minus on this sky minus, on this sky. And phi hat is going to be equal to, you know, this what we had in the last transparency, namely theta hat minus exactly this was the expression that we had in the last transparency. But now, the operator field F, the classical field F, has been replaced by an operator field, and we have normal ordering there with respect to eta. Over here, normal ordering with respect to eta and with respect to g is the same, so it doesn't really matter. And then, but quantum mechanically, classically, there's only field coming up here. Quantum mechanically, there are also vacuum fluctuations that I have to worry about, and therefore, I also have to do the same thing on sky minus. So, the boundary condition is given up here, and it is a boundary condition that links phi hat and theta hat with f hat. In other words, I can solve in these equations are many solutions. They are not all of interest. The only ones which are of interest are such that on this boundary, they are reduced by theta hat equal to this, and phi hat is equal to this. And then you can see the expressions that mathematically tells you that theta hat and phi hat are completely determined by this hat.
So is this just canonical quantization of
the classical theory? That would be, yeah. So you could do a canonical quantization of the classical theory, and you could get these equations. Okay. Or you could also do more covariant quantization. Okay. Either way.
Okay, so I guess what I was puzzled with is the fact that, well, I mean, here you have second order equations, presumably because, well, I can think of this as, you know, removing the momenta from the equation.
I did. That's exactly what I did. Because I wanted a space-time picture. I mean, I'm short-circuiting a lot of stuff. Yes.
And sort of the usual product ambiguity, is that an issue?
Yes. So that's definitely an issue. So there's an ambiguity about products, for example, in terms of this theta hat, theta hat, etc. So these equations are written formally.
Your double dots refer to normal ordering?
Yes. Normal ordering with respect to either eta or g doesn't matter because on sky minus, we agree. So the equations are written, they are written only formally here because they involve operator product expansions on the Fock space of f hat. Because I got this, you know, things like log of theta, or this is easy actually because it is theta is just an operator, it's not an operator value distribution, so that's perfectly well defined.
But if you substitute everything back here, the trace anomaly factor, you will see that here there are complicated nonlinear functionals that of field phi that I have to compute, and that involves operator dynamic expansion. And this is not something that has been done in great detail. I want to say right now, that right away, that this model has not been solved in complete detail. What has been done is really extracting physics to a certain approximation. But we know that there is a systematic procedure along the lines that Deutsch and Friedman have given, doing this operator product expansion in a very beautiful, nice way. That should be done at some stage, and but it has not been done.
I'm a bit confused about the boundary conditions. So you specify theta hat and phi hat on the scry minus, but what about f hat?
Okay. So f is not specified in scry minus. F is a true degree of freedom. And so these boundary conditions basically tie down the conformal factor with f. And what am I going to do is, what is a black hole? We'll see this in the next transparency. In talking about a black hole, we're going to specify a state for f. And that state will be such that it is a vacuum on scry minus, on left scry minus, and on this scry minus, it is a coherent state which is peaked at some incoming profile that you're going to get.
So you are going to have to tell theory what the boundary conditions are for the...
I'm going to have to tell this theory. So there are two issues. One is, there are equations and there are boundary conditions for these equations. Then there are states. There are many states. And I'm going to be interested only in the black hole sector of this theory, which will have, that is to say, I'm only going to look at not all of Fock space, not all states of the Fock space of F hat, but only certain states of Fock space in F hat. And I'll comment on that in one second.
Yeah, just could you say a little bit more about using the Fock space from Minkowski space for the quantization of the gravity field?
Right. So the statement is a problem. Somebody gives you these. It's exactly what happened in classical theory. And I just used the Minkowski space, solved the wave equation in Minkowski space. Then I had equations coming from the CGHS gravity theory. And given that F, I substituted and I obtained, it's like a gauge fixing in a way, I obtained what the dilaton field was and what the conformal factor field was. So we're doing similar things here. We're just trying to. Okay. The true degree of freedom is in Minkowski space. And is the scalar field, and we're quantizing the scalar field in using the Fock technique. So this is the Hilbert space that is being specified.
But do I understand right that you only really need the Hilbert space at square and minus? So.
Yeah. I think it's, but of course, you know, if you want it, you can think of these Hilbert spaces existing everywhere, because you know it depends. It's a Heisenberg picture or Schrodinger picture. But we need the Hilbert space to be given just a square minus. That's exactly right. And then
that's sufficient.
Okay. And now, this is the second point that I'm going to make, which is along the same lines. Just one second, let me make this point, which is along the same line. The point is that there are really two algebras that we have. One algebra, this is just for scalar field in the Minkowski space. It's just the algebra of field operators, f and pi, or if you like, f and f at two points, f at x, f at y, they satisfy the commutation relation, there's an algebra. Okay. Smeared field operators, that's it. This is a small algebra, let's call it. It is just generated by smeared field operators. Okay? And that small algebra, the states are all states on that small algebra. If you give me that algebra, I know all the states. That's what. So the back, when I say vacuum state here and a coherent state here, that all just refers to that small algebra. But on that Hilbert space, my big job is to extend, define new operators by operator product expansion. Okay? And this new algebra is a much more complicated algebra. But the interesting thing is that the state is already determined if I know the small algebra. And this is going to be important as we go on along. Yeah.
Just a quick comment here. Black hole in GR 14 comes from lambda u equal to 0. U is 0, except for a single.
No. This is a dynamical black hole.
But
it's a dynamical black hole, so that's not true. So in GR 2, black hole, dynamical black holes are not r mu nu equal to 0. Dynamical black holes are r mu nu is equal to t mu nu, where t mu nu is the stress energy of collapsing matter. And the same thing is true here. I'm not looking at Schwarzschild black holes. I'm looking at dynamical black holes, which are formed. That's what is important for Hawking effect also. Black hole is formed dynamically, and that is what evaporates.
When the scalar field is zero, the black hole will fall away.
The scalar field is zero, then we'll talk about it later. I mean, the statement is that there are black holes of the Schwarzschild type. I'll explain how they come about. But in this case, it is certainly true that I'm looking at dynamical black holes.
And the key point now is that we want to extract physics to approximation. So what we have is a framework, right, precise framework, that mathematical physicists have to come and actually give meaning to say that, yes, these equations are hyperbolic, yes, through existence uniqueness theorem, say, what is the domain on which these operators would exist, etc., etc. And what we're now going to do is to use some approximation. And there are two approximations. Now, the key question that we want to ask at the moment, we have this quantum, the framework of quantum theory. And in that framework, is it true that operators theta and phi hat are well-defined operators? Is it a well-defined operator field and operator value distribution on entire Minkowski space? Classically, it was true. They were defined in entire Minkowski space. Quantum mechanically, is it true? And secondly, what is the physical interpretation of the Heisenberg state? So this is the black hole state. The state, and this is the answer to Rob's question. So the states we are going to consider are all of the type vacuum state up here and the coherent state up here. Of course, I'm going to tell you what happens for such states. But this profile of the coherent state is arbitrary, and if I therefore take the span, linear span of this coherent state, I get a dense subspace of space. But I do want to consider vacuum state up here. I do want to consider one-sided collapse to talk about the kinds of black holes that we have in the classical theory. So, as Lee was saying, that we're specifying the state just on square minus up here. It's a Heisenberg state. We evolve these operators, and what is their interpretation? You see, the question is the same as in the classical theory. In the classical theory, we have got theta, phi, and f. F was solved in Minkowski space time. But the interpretation came from G. Because of G, there is a black hole. Same thing here. The statement is that I can always solve f everywhere in this Minkowski space time. There is no problem. The small algebra is the same as in Minkowski space. It is the operators phi hat and theta hat, and therefore the metric operator g hat, which are the non-trivial ones. And the physics is captured by what happens to the metric operator. And that is what we are going to extract using some approximation methods. So the first thing I would like to do, first approximation is called bootstrapping. And the goal of this approximation is to just develop intuition for the solutions of these operator equations we have. So we got these complicated operator equations, and the reason why they are so complicated is because of this coupling that we have. Of course, we have boundary conditions as well, but even to solve these equations, I got phi and theta, and then here, again, there's a non-complicated trace anomaly that I can compute, and that trace anomaly itself depends on this omega, so these are nonlinear coupled equations up here. So one idea is to do bootstrapping. Just assume, fiducially, that the metric is some metric. Just choose one, convenient. Calculate the trace anomaly, solve these equations. When you can solve these equations, then you can define omega. Therefore, I'll get a physical metric G. I take that physical metric, look at the conformal factor of that physical metric, compute the trace anomaly of that physical metric, I get to solve it. And I can keep repeating this process, and this is bootstrapping. So again, I don't want to say that this is necessarily convergent or this is necessarily physically very interesting thing to do, but there is some, one gets some intuition about the kinds of solutions that we have, and that is what I want to emphasize. So, idea is to replace G hat on the right-hand side of the dynamical equations, that is to say the trace anomaly, by a symmetric G naught. And the simplest choice would be just to choose G naught hat to be equal to just eta. I did this yesterday, I did this today again.
Maybe.
So we have here the symmetric eta. The trace anomaly is just trace anomaly of eta, which is just zero. Then the dynamical equations are just, there was a right hand side here that just vanishes. And then the dynamical equations are very simple, d plus d minus of log of theta is equal to 0, d plus d minus of phi hat, in this case, kappa squared theta hat is equal to 0. These are very easy to solve. You can solve for this one first, take the solution, substitute here. And the solutions are that theta hat is equal to exponential kappa this. This, by the way, is the system. I don't know why I switched the rotation. This e to the minus kappa, etc. Okay, now just plus or minus, I think it was, kappa squared x plus x minus. So that's the same solution that we had on the last time. For instance, I'm just writing out for some reason in terms of, I should have just kept it in terms of x plus x minus.
So this is a solution for theta hat. Then I can get the solution for phi hat. And these are well-defined operator value distributions everywhere in the Minkowski space. Therefore, phi hat is a well-defined operator value distribution in the Minkowski space. And then I have g hat defined like that.
So these are the same equations you'd get as if h bar were zero, right? Because then you'd have
these are the same equations as I would get.
No trace anomaly. Then.
Except that, yeah, because there's no trace anomaly. Except that now I'm allowing if h bar was zero, then I'll also
allowing an f minus term. But you could have done that before.
Yes, we've done that. So this term is allowed, and now we get here g hat. So we get the g hat, and now the idea would be to try to compute g hat to trace anomaly, use this as a seed metric, and again solve the dynamical equation, etc. But let us see what happens already at the first end of this first step. End of this first step, we find that g hat is a perfectly well-defined operator value distribution on M1, and this is basically the point that Rob is making. That it's not surprising because that was happening in the classical theory, and all we have done is to replace various classical fields by operators on Fock space, and these are all the slight amount of checking to be done that you don't have problems with, you know, operator value distribution products and so on that are involved here. But the claim is that yes, that is all fine, and we have got a good operator value distribution, which is defined everywhere. And indeed, if I take the expectation value in our preferred state of g1 hat, I just get the classical metric. Similarly, expectation value of the dilaton, I get the classical solution, and here is the classical solution. So the expectation value of this operator's equations is just a classical solution, as one might have thought. Now this, if I now compute the expected metric, this metric was singular because the expectation value of omega 1 hat vanishes. One is just because I'm only doing the first step in this bootstrapping. But the point is that expectation value vanishes, but the operator omega 1 hat, it's an operator value distribution. It's a perfectly well-defined operator value distribution. And as an operator value distribution, it doesn't vanish. You know, expectation value in some state may vanish, but there are fluctuations. And the operator doesn't vanish in any sense. I mean, it's not a zero operator on that set. And therefore, the statement is and what one finds is exactly what one might think, that near where the classical singularity was, this is a well-defined operator value distribution, and it has very large fluctuations. It has very large fluctuations. And so near the singularity, the mean field approximation or the expectation values that we have got here are a poor representation of what is happening. I find that the expectation value of omega 1 vanishes. I find the expectation value of g1 vanishes. But the fluctuations are so large that I shouldn't be so concerned about the fact that the expectation value vanishes. It's just telling me that if I were to use the classical theory, which is the same as just using expectation values, I'm making huge mistakes. That doesn't capture the true physics there at all.
What's the definition of large?
Good point. So I think in this case one has to go back where the dimensional constant, k is a dimensional constant, length squared. So h bar, and one of the interesting things in 2 plus 1 dimension is that h bar and g have h bar is mass times length, and g is 1 upon mass times length. So in fact, h bar is a Planck number. So using these things, one can write down explicitly what one means by large fluctuations. You can just take, for example, it will just divert me a lot because I'm telling how the smearing was done because an operator value distribution. And then again, the dimension of the smearing function, so it'll take.
But you mean the basically like the expectation value of omega 1 squared is big in units of h bar g.
Yeah. And omega vanishes in expected, h bar g, the expected value of omega squared is.
Okay.
And you have to be careful about whether you're using h bar g or also you're bringing in this k.
Okay.
Do you mean that the expectation value of omega squared is like proportional to 1 over omega or something like that? That when I go to omega, it goes to 0? Yeah.
The thing is that I just smear things properly, and so because this omega is actually an operator value distribution, and so I have to tell you also about what is happening to my smearing functions. It's a physical procedure to really approach a singularity. You have to take the limit in a certain way. This is a very delicate issue, which I think I have to postpone to the discussion period.
Is there any equivalent of positive energy conditions which are essential for the Hawking-Penrose theorems?
I don't know if there are singularity theorems which I've shown in this model. One is focusing mainly on just black holes in this particular model. One has many usual ideas that come up, but on the other hand, I do not know what the state of singularity is.
Could I keep large fluctuations to give you large trace anomalies that will then make the iterative process?
Because the thing has to do with trace anomalies, has to do with scalar curvature, the scalar curvature is large, and therefore that's what's happening. Yeah.
G-hat and G-hat inverse, are they both defined operate operator value?
No. So here the statement is that, it depends on what you mean by universal. It's an operator value distribution, right? So it's not an operator. So you have to smear it with a smearing field. And that is a well-defined operator. So that's a statement. There are literally infinitely many complications which are simplified because just to finish the time. So there are two more things that I have to say. I think points will be clear. Then the question is, okay, you get this solutions at the end of first bootstrapping, but they are finite, they are well-defined everywhere, and the fluctuations are large, that looks okay. But maybe you got the completely fluke solution. Does it have anything good with respect to physics? So what we now want to do is what is the interpretation of our favorite state? Our favorite state is this state up here. And we want to ask, what is the interpretation of our favorite state up here? In the mean field geometry of G1 hat up here. Now G1 hat is just a classical background metric. And therefore, at sky plus, right sky plus up here of G1, this is the expectation value. The Heisenberg state that I got up here. Okay. Now, here it's not a test field or anything. This is an important point. I'm not involving a test field. I'm just looking at the Heisenberg state, which made the black hole. And I take this Heisenberg state with full quantum gravity, and in this truncation, I find out what is its interpretation. And this is again for the same reason as before, that namely, because this sky is smaller than sky in Minkowski space, you have to do some tracing. And if I look at here, G and eta, or G1 and eta are the same. Here, G1 and eta are different from each other. Therefore, there is positive and negative frequency mixing. You do the calculation in detail, and you find precisely that there is a thermal density matrix up here. So this state, this Heisenberg state in the Fock space, which is living all around, is in fact, with respect to the first bootstrapping approach to measure metric is precisely the Hawking radiation state. So it's capturing physics reasonably well, and we can think about that the operators phi and theta hat we have are not some exotic finite solutions, but they capture the physics quite well. And this is just that you can also calculate the Hawking effect using the trace anomaly calculation in the quantum gravity framework, and you get the same answer. But what happens is that now I would have loved to go back and feed this metric back and then see what happens, right? The second loop. Unfortunately, the second loop, the calculation is almost as hard as the full calculation. It turns out to be extremely hard. There are too many products of operator value distributions, and I feel that we might as well then solve the full theory. But what we want to know is what happens to the Hawking radiation, and for that, there is a second approximation that can be introduced, and that is called the mean field approximation. So to address the issue of information loss, we have to incorporate it, at least the back reaction, if not more. And the mean field approximation idea is the following. We've got all these operators, and what we're going to do is we're going to ignore quantum fluctuations of the geometry operator, but not of the field operator, or the matter field operator that we got. That means that we're not going to ignore the trace anomaly. If we did that, we'd just go back to the classical theory. But we're actually ignoring the fluctuations in theta hat and phi. That is to say, we have the operator value distributions, we take their expectation value. Wherever there is a product of theta and phi, we just replace the expectation value of the product of theta and phi by product of the expectation value of theta and phi. So basically, we're asking that f of theta hat and phi hat be the same as f of the expectation value of theta hat and expectation value of phi hat. In this approximation, the dynamics is just governed. Still complicated equations, but these are classical equations now, and then I can solve that. Where I got here,
the wave equation, which can be with respect to eta or with respect to g. And then we've got the equations up here for the trace anomalies that I got up here. And of course, we've got the boundary condition. So these equations we get up here, they are obtained from more algebraic or field theory, but from the more traditional point of view, the approximation is equivalent to making a large N approximation. We have got large number of matter fields, and therefore quantum fluctuations of the matter fields are important, but we can ignore the quantum fluctuations of geometry compared to the quantum fluctuations of the matter field. This is an approximation which will hold in a large regime, but it will fail somewhere and go to lower. So these equations have been looked at by Low and Spirano's quadrature, and the picture that they had gotten was the following. If you include this back reaction, these equations include back reactions. Then the picture is that we have got this state which is coming in and causing the black hole to form. It is in fact a dynamical horizon which develops, but because of the leakage of Hawking radiation, it is while in space like here. Because of the leakage of Hawking radiation, it becomes time-like, it shrinks, and shrinks to zero up here. And the equations are perfectly well-defined in some region like that. But of course, they break down where the classical singularity was. Or, in our picture, wherever the quantum fluctuations of geometry are absolutely huge. So even if you have n very large, no matter how large n is, there's a neighborhood of this little singularity, classical singularity, where the quantum fluctuations of geometry would be larger than the quantum fluctuations of matter for any given n. And therefore, these mean field equations break down. And what people had said was that, well, I can evolve up to here. And then they made a reasonable expected extension that I can extend up here. And up to here, I think one can justify it numerically that this is the correct solution. But then they said that, well, here the black hole has evaporated. So at this point in scrum, the body mass is zero. So I can just add this triangular flat space by hand. This is what was done up here. And then in this picture, then information is still lost because the future boundary, there is still a future boundary here. So now what happens? So we're going to make certain assumptions. These assumptions were also made in all the analysis before, but I want to make them explicit here. We're going to assume that the quantum equations do admit a regular solution on some portion m bar of the full Minkowski manifold that we got. M bar may be a subset of m, we do not know a priori. But we know from the mean field approximations, from the numerical solutions, that in fact is an extension of the classical space time. Second thing we're going to assume is that this mean metric that we got, it has large fluctuations, but as you go to sky plus, as you go away from the singularity, it becomes asymptotically flat, and therefore there is a right scrub which is well defined. And this right scrub may be a proper subset of that of Minkowski space. So I got Minkowski space up here, and there is a physical right scrub, maybe only part of it. We don't know. This is what we want to find out. If it is only, okay. And then that the body flux vanishes somewhere and remains zero in the future of that. So the black hole has evaporated, and then to the future, nothing comes out. And then the mean field approximation holds in some neighborhood here. We're not asking that the mean field approximation holds in the interior where there is a classical singularity or large fluctuations of the metric, but we say that if you go far away from that region asymptotically, the mean field approximation should hold here. So these are the approximations that are being made. Again, I want to emphasize that these approximations are made everywhere. For example, if in fact scrub did not exist, I can't even ask the question, is the information lost? The question is completely meaningless. I don't even know where to compute the outgoing state. That the body mass actually vanishes when the black hole has evaporated, and then it's zero, was also assumed in the previous numerical analysis. Okay. So the new idea, and this is the last thing that I want to explain to you. The new idea is to say that I want to understand the mean field approximation in the neighborhood of sky up here. So here, I'm going to do an asymptotic expansion.
I know what the class asymptotically flat matrix look like, asymptotically flat Hilbertians look like. So I'm going to use the mean field equations and do an asymptotic expansion and determine the leading order behavior of the matrix. And the idea is that in some region like that, we're assuming that the classic, the quantum metric is well defined, its expectation value is well defined. And therefore, the GAB, the physical expectation value of the physical metric, is given by omega, conformal factor, times eta, where z minus is the Minkowski coordinates running up here. And what one finds on this mean field equation, which was reasonably pleasant surprise to me, is the following. That after the Hawking evaporator, after the body mass becomes zero, in fact, this omega is constant. In the distant past, omega is given by what it is given in the classical Schwarzschild solution or classical black hole solution. That's not very surprising, because in the distant past, hardly any Hawking effect or radiation has been emitted. In distant past, this should look like classical space-time. That is what happens. But in the future, this is not an assumption. The mean field approximation says that, in fact, this omega of z, z minus, is in fact constant in this region. What this means is that scry plus of this physical metric and scry plus of Minkowski metric are equally long. Now, why is this important? It's important for the following reason. Remember, we give ourselves this state. And we want to know what happens to this state here. And the thing is that just looking at the field algebra of F operators on Minkowski spacetime, we already know that this state, which is a vacuum state with respect to the Minkowski metric, if I look at Minkowski spacetime up here. So if my scribe were this, then this is just a vacuum state of Minkowski spacetime. That's what it is. But now what we're showing is that in fact the physical scribe is exactly as long as Minkowski's scribe. So there are no things to be traced over anymore. You see, in the Hawking effect, we got a density matrix because the physical scribe was smaller than Minkowski's scribe. So even if you had a vacuum state, so this is Minkowski's scribe, say, and I had a perfectly decent vacuum state with respect to Minkowski metric up here. But physical scribe that was available was just this. So I trace over these modes. But now, the physical scribe that is available is exactly the same as in Minkowski spacetime. Therefore, I don't have to trace over anything. So it's actually a pure state. But the next question is, okay, it's a pure state, but is it, what is its physical interpretation? Is it in the future Fock space with respect to G? Because even if the two scribes are equally long, G is not equal to eta, G is equal to eta or constant times eta in the future, but G is a complicated function of omega of z times eta over here. Therefore, the key question that we want to ask is this state that I got, scry minus, I got a vacuum state, this evolves to the vacuum state of Minkowski's metric up here. Is the vacuum state of Minkowski metric in the Fock space of G in future scry? And the answer is yes. These two conditions have been shown to imply, and this was a nice calculation that this Victor Tavares made, that this calculation to show that in fact the time translations of G and eta are such that this is in fact in the future Fock space of G. The Bogoliubov transformation is well defined. So let me summarize. I'll come back to this transformation in a minute, but let me just summarize using something else up here. What I'm plotting up here is the following. I got this physical scribe, this scribe in Minkowski spacetime, which is plotted here, z minus. Z minus is going to from minus infinity to plus infinity. This is the time translation coordinate of the physical scribe. In the classical metric, what happens is that the time translation coordinate of physical scribe starts out basically like the time translation of Minkowski metric in distant past. And as time evolves, however, it increases rapidly and reaches infinite value at a finite value of Minkowski's scry. So I got Minkowski's scry going to infinity here, going to minus infinity here. And the physical scry is only up to here, and now I find parameter y is reaching infinite value right here. And therefore, this portion is missing. What is happening in the mean field theory
coming from full quantum gravity is that in the distant past the picture is the same, but instead of y rising so steeply, in fact it interpolates and becomes proportional to Minkowski's curve, just c times z plus a constant, it just becomes like that in the distant future. And therefore, whenever y is infinite, z is also infinite. That is why the physical scar is as long as the Minkowski scar. So what does this all tell us? This tells us that unlike in the truncated bootstrapping, quantum spacetime is larger than the classical one. The bootstrapping, so to say, the classical spacetime is ended here. Here the quantum spacetime is larger. We already knew that the vacuum state here is some state with respect to Fock space of Minkowski spacetime defined on Sky-Class. But the important thing is that we can now show that this is in fact a pure state with respect to, in the Fock space, defined by the physical metric G up here, where G is obtained by solving the mean field equations. So unlike in the truncated theory, or after the first step in bootstrapping, quantum spacetime is larger than classical, and now this state is actually pure state, but it is populated by particles. It looks thermal at early times, but correlations are restored because this is a pure state, and Sky-Class is larger than the one in the classical. Sky-Class of the quantum corrected spacetime is larger than in the classical. So let me summarize. Even in the context of this simple two-dimensional models, information loss puzzle has been open for over 15 years. Both in classical and quantum theory, dynamics is trivial on m naught eta. F just dynamics of F is completely trivial. All the deep physics is in interpreting this solution using the physical geometry in classical theory and the physical metric in quantum theory. Physical quantum metric in the quantum theory. Non-triviality because the physical metric G, and the question is what is the interpretation of the vacuum state on the Minkowski spacetime in the asymptotic future of the physical metric. If in fact you stop at the first step of truncation, then the expected value of the physical metric is just equal to the classical one, and then this is a thermal state, thermal density matrix. But of course, this is only an approximation. In this approximation, we find that in fact the quantum fluctuations of the metric are very large near where the classical singularity was. We cannot trust it completely. It ignores back reaction. And when you actually take into account back reaction, then and make certain assumptions which are made even to ask the question if there is information loss, one finds that there is no information loss. And the reason is because the quantum spacetime is bigger than the classical one. Its Sky-Class is longer. Even in the first order bootstrapping, quantum operators are fine. The problem is only with the expectation values. And therefore, this motivates us to conjecture that in the full theory, the quantum operators will also be fine. However, as I emphasized in the middle of the talk, we have not solved the full theory. One, some deep mathematical physics analysis is necessary to solve those operator equations, that is to say, to show the existence and uniqueness of solutions, the given boundary condition, the operator equations. What we assume is that the operator equations can be solved, that the quantum metric G is such that the distant future, if the expectation values will be asymptotically flat, and then we use the mean field equation just near scrub to conclude that scrub of the physical metric is as long as scrub of the Minkowski metric. As soon as you have done that, you know that the pure state is a pure state, but is it a really regular pure state in the Fock space of G? That requires a calculation, and that calculation was also done. The claim is that yes, it is populated by particles. In order to understand the deep physics of what is coming out, when does the information come out, what is the physical content, until what time does it really look like Hawking radiation, and when are the correlations restored and all that. In order to do that, what we have to do is to really understand, not necessarily the full theory, but to understand this theory. What is the functional form of y with respect to z in this in-between dynamical regime? This is a solution where the body masses all evaporate away. This is a solution at early time. And this is the interpolating solution. That is what we are to find out. Unfortunately, Franz Pretorius has his interest in this problem, and he's solving these equations numerically. Hopefully, he will tell us what is the y is a function of z. If we know what y is a function of z, then we will be able to tell in detail all these questions about when the correlation is restored, what is happening, etc. There's also some very beautiful work that is being done by Amos Ori, from people in Israel on this. He has developed analytical approximation methods to solve our equations. And it is a series of approximations, but it's very beautiful work. And that work also confirms that the overall picture is exactly like this, but the question is about, in other words, we did only an asymptotic analysis. He's actually trying to evolve from inside, but making certain approximations, and then the approximation is satisfied, reproduces all these results. So I think there's going to be sort of convergence coming from numerical side and from this semi-classical approximations that Ramos is making, and we'll have a good picture in the next few months or so.
For a few questions, so
there was a paper a couple of years ago by Tommy about just by the Gansberg and Norman Strauss on information loss in situ and black holes. They considered the collapse of a domain wall, and they included back reaction. Do you know about that work?
Yeah, but I've forgotten. I did know at the time, but I've forgotten about. But if you have a specific question, then you can come back.
They conclude that as far as the observer seeing a forming black hole, it never really forms in the sense that you don't stop seeing.
Yeah, so
it evaporates before it forms.
So I don't know if this is true here. So in this two-dimensional model, I'm not sure that that's actually real. I mean, there are these questions also about what is the time scale of the. So I think again, these numerical solutions will actually tell us exactly what happens.
They did it numerically.
Right, but our numerical solutions in two-dimensional also tell us what
exactly. So on future scry on the right, scry plus, what you have written down is omega is a constant pi and omega is a function down low, which is C0 at best. Is the expectation that omega is going to smoothly decay to zero when you do it right, or will there be some kind of discontinuity?
So these are exactly the questions that, my expectation is that it will actually do smoothly. Within the analytical approximations that are valid for Amos's calculations, it also is doing smoothly. But again, I think it's really the numerical nonlinear evolution that will tell us this. So it doesn't go to zero, it goes to a constant, omega goes to zero.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a function that you can match, but the derivative is not smooth, right? The derivative jumps, so I'm asking, is it going to smooth?
Right. But the derivative could jump again. It jumps. I mean, the distant past is something. The derivative is not zero. The distant future is zero. And the question is whether it is actually going to join on in a C1 way or something. Or C2
yeah, that's
way.
My question. But C1, C2.
Yeah, so my expectation is yes, but this is not something that we can prove. And the reason is because of, when we do this, when we do these solutions, right, we're already assuming that these equations are valid. Those equations already require that these fields phi and so on are C2, at least in the x d by dx plus and d by dx minus, or d by dz plus and d by dz minus directions. So I think the best thing is really just to let this, in the asymptotic analysis, we are assuming that it has this property with respect to these two coordinates, so we cannot really, it doesn't shed any light. I think this exact numerical solutions will tell us.
There's this old argument about why information is probably lost. It has to do with the fact that if I formed a truly large black hole, a huge black hole that was formed a very long time ago, there's a lot of information contained inside that somehow has to find its way outside. And I guess from your picture, I get the suggestion that, well, there should be a deviation from the thermal spectrum, but probably occurring late in the evaporation, and there's probably a critical temperature where it starts happening, which is probably the Planck temperature.
I don't know but
the point is that you still have a massive amount of information to leak out, and do you have an intuition as to whether this happens gradually? There's a memory. There seems to be a memory that's required.
Yeah. So I think, roughly speaking, information. So we've done these calculations about. question about when does information come out, I'm not comfortable with, okay, because I cannot define it. But if I just do the calculation that other people do about how, you know, basically tracing out certain degrees of freedom and seeing what happens, then roughly the picture is what people sometimes draw, which is that roughly when the mass of the black hole is about half the total mass, there are slow deviations from Hawking effect. And slow, I mean, the small deviations, very small deviations, right? And the information starts leaking out then. And if I look at the flux of energy, that by itself doesn't show much change, because that doesn't care about information, that just takes the stretching against the research. But if I look at the state itself, then roughly it is really when roughly half of the, I don't know if it's half a curve, but some macroscopic part of the mass of the black hole has is still in the black hole, that the correlation started getting restored.
So in your picture, I mean, as soon as the black hole forms, the leakage could start.
Yes.
And there's enough
time. So one of the questions about this time scale that has come up, and so this four dimensional, I don't know, but two dimensional statement is that in fact, the time scale is really the Hawking evaporation time scale, that the whole information comes out. In other words, nothing comes through the singular region, so to say, very quickly. Yeah. The time scale is really the Hawking evaporation time scale. And it really is, I mean, the physical intuition that one has is that negative flux is falling into the black hole and, so to say, neutralizing that singularity slowly so that there is very little mass. So that, in fact, if I drew something in the future, if I drew something in the future of, so, if I drew a surface which goes like this, for example, then I would find that in fact very little is coming out in this region. One of the things, but other than some, you know, other than one of the, I should just say it, the usual picture is that this is flat. So, using just asymptotic analysis, one can try to compute is it flat or not. Of course, by assumption, we are assuming that this is asymptotically flat here. But I can calculate, is it true that the Ricci scalar here is actually zero, as opposed to it just dying at some rate? And in fact, it should die at some rate because of asymptotic flatness. But if I say, supposing it dies as R is this distance up here, and if I just rescale R times the Ricci scalar, and ask, does it have finite limit? And it has a finite limit. So it doesn't look at all like this portion is flat, which is the usual thing that is asked. And one might say, why is this portion not flat? Well, over here the mass is zero, or very small. But the thing is that if I have a point like that, the geometry here is determined by, in a backward evolution, by what is happening here and what is happening here. And this, by the way, is not flat at all. And so, therefore, this the assumption that this corner is flat, which is always there, I think that can be shown to be manifestly wrong.
One more short question.
One more. I took a minimally coupled Einstein scale of gravity, 4D, and I found a class of non-singular solutions. Non-singularity had a zero low event horizon. However, I had to give up one of the positive energy conditions as I approached zero, which of course agrees with the universe zero. So, but it was critical that T mu scalar never vanishes. As soon as it vanishes, you get, I mean, you go zero, you get disruption of black hole. So, there's a lot to learn still from the classical theory about this whole issue.
Yeah, certainly a lot to learn about classical theory. We don't understand cosmic censorship, we don't understand dynamical black holes in four dimensions. There are a lot to learn.
So let's thank our speaker again.